Welcome back to the Infotagent podcast, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom. This is the first major public health crisis in the age of social media disinformation, and we're here to try and make sense of it. I'm Damien Collins MP, co-founder of Infotagent, and today we're joined by Professor Philip Howard, the director of the Oxford Internet Institute and professor of internet studies at Balliol College, University of Oxford. He is also the author of a new book, Lie Machines: How to Save Democracy from Troll Armies, Deceitful Robots, Junk News Operations, and Political Operatives. Alongside him is Peter Pomerantsev, a senior fellow at the London School of Economics and author of This Is Not Propaganda: Adventures in the War Against Reality. We'll also be hearing, as always, from our resident experts, the disinformation analyst Dr. Charles Creel and John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs. In this podcast, we'll be talking about disinformation networks and how they operate around the world. Phil Howard, if I could come to you first. You've done a huge amount of work as director of the Oxford Internet Institute, looking at the way disinformation works, the way it's been used as a weapon by other countries. And looking at the current crisis we're in now, do you think there is a heightened level of public awareness in the issue of disinformation because it's linked to a medical emergency rather than just being about a political incident around an election or state interference from a country like Russia?
That's a good question. I do think public awareness is pretty high. In part, that's because people want to find out the truth, and everyone's well tuned into sort of the politicized health news about what's going on. But I think also journalists are getting better at reporting on misinformation trends. It's sort of become a news peg on its own. So there's a lot more coverage of what bad, low-quality media outlets are putting out there about COVID.
Do you think there's been a bit of background awareness raising of the issue over the last couple of years? I mean, for me, certainly thinking back to when we did the Select Committee investigations, disinformation, it felt that around the time of the investigations into Russian interference in the presidential election in America, which seemed to coincide with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, that became the moment where it became a more mainstream thing to talk about. But probably COVID-19 has made it more directly relevant to people.
I think that's right. And in between those two times, we saw more and more single issues become sort of riled up or get choked off because of misinformation. So everybody had their favorite issue on the right and the left infected. Public conversation about multiple issues were infected by misinformation. I think now that we're in the middle of a public health crisis where the myths about coronavirus are themselves deadly, that makes it part of being aware of misinformation actually becomes part of good public health. It becomes part of protecting yourself to figure out what stories are patently false and what sources are credible.
I mean, one of the things we've tried to do with Infotagent is to try and create a change in public mindset as well, so that disinformation is something that people call out and they actively seek to check. I think one of the problems we've encountered is that, certainly with a health emergency, many people feel that they will share something in case it's true rather than in some ways doing the opposite, not sharing unless they've checked to know it's definitely true. And I wonder with your new book, Lie Machines, I mean, do you also feel with that these are still issues that citizens need to be more aware of, what their role is in combating disinformation?
Absolutely. We're, as individuals, we're sort of the first line of defense. It's up to us to decide what to share with our friends and family. And it's important to teach people that we need to do just that little bit of extra due diligence, especially on something that's as deadly as COVID. You know, we need to do that due diligence before we push things along our social networks. I would still say that the platforms have a responsibility at a structural level to do as much as they can to stop the flow of misinformation, especially when the flow of misinformation is taking advantage of their own algorithms, right? The algorithms they've chosen to implement on their sites.
I mean, where as well do you see the responsibility of the big tech companies lying in this regard as well? Because I would certainly feel that citizens have a part to play, but also the companies that are curating this content as well. They're allowing their systems to be used to let it reach other people. Do you feel that they're still not doing enough to combat the spread of disinformation and to combat the active networks and groups and channels that are being used to spread it?
Well, they're definitely doing more than they ever did around more clearly political issues, issues that didn't have to do with public health. I think some of the research we've been doing at Oxford shows that YouTube, the average person searching for COVID information on YouTube won't find the junk news. They'll find professionally produced news content on YouTube. They won't find stuff from the WHO or NHS Mayo Clinic. They won't find advice from doctors, but they won't find the junk stuff unless they go searching for it. That conspiratorial content still exists on the platforms, but it is getting harder and harder to find.
And now, there's another group as well I want to ask your opinion about in terms of their responsibilities, because I noticed in the preface to your book, you posed the interesting question about what is a political lie? Politicians get things wrong, and sometimes they knowingly mislead. And we've seen Twitter take action against some of the tweets of the president of Brazil because it believed that they were deliberately misleading. And as we know, President Trump's tweets speak for themselves, as the White House constantly tells us. Where do you think the responsibility lies here? I mean, how do you perhaps you could explain how you define the idea of a political lie in your book, as opposed to just someone getting something wrong? And do you feel that current leaders are doing enough to make sure what they say is accurate and as helpful as possible?
As possible. So the thing I refer to as a lie machine is this combination of a social organization, a bunch of people generating misinformation, and the technical system for distributing it, and then usually another set of consultants who do marketing research to make sure that the messages get delivered to the users who will be activated or discouraged from voting on voting day. And that's a very large mechanism that crosses borders and generates a lot of money or revenue for firms and the platforms themselves. I do think the case of the U.S. president is the toughest one to think about, because on the one hand, the things he generates do violate Twitter's community standards for communication, but they allow him to keep his account because he's a special category of public figure who, just by virtue of being in office, should be allowed to say whatever he wants. Now, I didn't know that about how Twitter was dealing with Bolsonaro, and so I assume they've either decided he doesn't have that stature, or that misinformation around COVID is a special category of content, and politicized health news may be one of the things you could silence a political figure on if they're getting it so patently wrong that they're causing public harm.
Now, Peter Pomerantsev, I wonder if I could bring you into the conversation at this point. Peter is someone who helped us with the Select Committee investigation, and I was also pleased to join him at the Folkestone Book Festival last year to talk about his latest book, This Is Not Propaganda. And people that have read your book, I think, will be struck by the analysis of just the scale of disinformation when it's part of a coordinated campaign, that this is a highly sophisticated operation for the people that excel in it. And I mean, do you feel that, again, that the coronavirus has been caught up in the system that was already in place? Or do you feel that it's the agents of disinformation are actively seeking to exploit what's going on at the moment?
I'm sure it's a little bit of both, but just from where I sit, I see kind of a radicalization of a process that was happening already. Radicalization because it really is about human lives now. It's not just about votes. And it's very interesting seeing a few sort of trends emerging. I mean, this connection between health disinformation and politics has always been very interesting. I mean, on American kind of conspiracy websites, so we always kind of like, we also advertise kind of magic pills to make you stronger as well. There was always like a Venn diagram between health and sort of populist politics and populist rhetorics. But I think they're really coming together now into a very, very dangerous mix, because you're seeing sort of the undermining of official science and scientific advice, is now coming together with a whole political movement, especially in the US. So you have this kind of politicization of health, and that there's also a commercial side to that. You know, so you know, don't believe the governments about their COVID, what to do about COVID. Drink these magic pills instead. But that's a very, very toxic mix that we're seeing emerge. This kind of the commercial interests of pushing alternative remedies, the political interests of trying to undermine epistemic authority, but with huge kind of consequences for the public. I think is a new mutation in dare I say the virus of disinformation.
I mean in your book, one of the countries you looked at was the Philippines, where you know Facebook practically is the internet in countries like that for most people. I mean, do you have a sense of how disinformation around COVID is affecting different parts of the world at the moment, and whether in some of the places you looked at for your book, the problems that they're encountering are even worse than we're seeing here?
So in a way, actually, Western countries can be more affected by COVID because we're less resilient. So actually, we've been looking at Ukraine, which is one of the epicenters of today's information war. Both, it's a kind of quite a high tech society actually in terms of internet penetration and just in terms of kind of its use of digital services. You've got obviously a huge Russian disinformation campaign that is world famous. The greatest information blitzkrieg in history, it was called by one of the heads of NATO. But then you have massive internal disinformation and a very low trust society. So you have all the ingredients for complete information chaos. Now, on the one hand, Ukrainians are pretty resilient. So for them, COVID is just one more crisis. If you've been invaded recently, if you have survived the 1990s, you have actually much deeper levels of social resilience than maybe we do here. So that's, a funny angle. But what we did see in Ukraine is these very strange social media campaigns, which were really about kind of, what I suppose you could call othering, about fear of the other, about the fear specifically of, Ukrainians coming back from China or Ukrainians coming back from Italy and they're carrying the disease. And they were actually small riots, very small and very strange. There is strange leadership. A lot of people suspect some sort of organization behind these riots, that they weren't completely spontaneous. But basically, they were kind of rocks were hurled at buses full of Ukrainians coming back from China. And that actually led us, I lead a small research initiative at the LSE. We did a little bit of research, just how are Ukrainians reacting to different forms of media about COVID? How much stuff are they getting off the internet? Just to try to understand to what extent is the disinformation actually leading to extremism and the potential for violence.
I think we've noticed with Infotagen, probably two broad groups of disinformation. There is, one which is medical conspiracies theories, really around cures and how to avoid getting it. But then there's another area which seems to be more political, which is a kind of who's to blame for all of this. And China, and obviously there's a huge debate around China itself, and indeed even some allegations that the Chinese state is seeking to spread some confusion as to how COVID may have originated, to absolve themselves of some of the blame for this. This sort of feels like probably disinformation around China or from China is something that COVID has brought into more public focus, where in the past we principally spoke about it coming from countries like Russia or Iran. I'd be interested in your views on this, on disinformation linked to China, and also how maybe disinformation on COVID is being used to further different political agendas as well.
So the China aspect, look, for those of us who've been watching this world for a while, China has long been a player. I mean, internally, they have something called the 50 Cent Army, which makes the Russian troll farm look like small bear. It's, large sort of like sort of cyber militias, which post pro-government messaging. things that's largely in Chinese and was largely domestic apart from Taiwan. So for a long time, we've seen quite aggressive Chinese social media operations in Taiwan, which are reminiscent of the stuff that Russia does in its so-called near abroad, so undermining politicians they don't like. So it's not as if China is completely new. I think what is newer is China suddenly going global with this stuff. And again, it's not just the disinformation from the online work. It is also, you know, very, very, very aggressive messaging from their, you know, ambassadors and official representatives, which is something we're long familiar with Russia, sort of the trolling diplomats. But now they've embraced it. And of course, that is only being encouraged by an American president who is himself a trolling president. So that's been a big development, and that's kind of very brash. But we're yet to see what the fallout of that will be. Russia is a country that has, in a way, little to lose and is happy playing the joker in the international system. You know, it's happy playing the chaos monkey. China has been selling itself as something quite different, as a kind of, you know, as a source of stability in a chaotic world. And I wonder to what extent the fallout is going to be. So for the first time, I think we see, you know, a measure of agreement between democracies, that China is now a problem, and certainly bipartisan agreement in the US. And that's kind of new. About international, look, Russia is always up to its usual games. However, I'd say overall, my sense is the Russians are actually keeping their cards close to their chests and wondering what is their approach going to be. I mean, they're obviously doing their usual kind of pushing out conspiracies, undermining trust, the kind of you know strategic narratives that we're used to seeing from Russia and Russian aligned actors. But I think overall, they don't really have a dog in this fight. It could be a chance for them to make nice with Europe. Again, we see them making overtures, you know, sending to the White House, but also sending kind of like humanitarian convoys to Italy. So actually, you know, I'm not, you know, this is weirdly a fight they don't have a clear position on. And I think they're sort of like, you know, biding their time to see what exactly they're going to do with it. China, as you say, much more clearly aggressive. The political forces, look, it's a funny one. Look, extremists have been emboldened. You know, the online extremists are pushing their messages that, you know, this is a strong argument for closing borders. We don't want any of those foreigners with their viruses here, as expected. However, you know, if we're talking about the large populist movements in Europe, who fed off an anti-state narrative, an anti-authority narrative, an antitrust narrative, you know, they seem quieter. Salvini in Italy has gone quiet. I think it's been a long time since the Italian government has had such high approval ratings. Merkel is just I think the word in today's parlance is the bomb. In this crisis, she's just completely crushed the AfD. So I don't know. It's actually, this is one of these moments where trust in authority and trust is it becomes a little bit higher among the mainstream of the population. I don't know if that will last. That might fray as we come out of this, as we come out of lockdown, as the economic costs harden. But my sense is there is a small moment for, you know, beleaguered centrists to actually have their day in the sun.
I mean, Phil and Peter, if I could just ask you one final question for me is, I mean, this is obviously a big year for the world because of coronavirus, but also a big election in America in November, which could be quite close. Now, what trends do you think we should look out for in disinformation as we go through the summer into the autumn?
Well, Damien, as you know, I look at disinformation, and not just me. This is a lot of analysts think about disinformation in several categories. There's disinforming content, which in the case of Corona is like, you know, drink bleach, which is very dangerous and very pernicious. But actually, you know, once we're out of direct health risks, very, very hard to regulate. You know, it's also a very big year for regulation. We should remember that. Internet regulation is coming. But regulating disinforming content when it comes to politics is really, really, really hard. And you know that because you've tried to, you know, the parliamentary committee was dedicated to it. But I think we're seeing consensus, at least among the expert community, that we should be regulating against disinforming behavior. So what the platforms themselves call coordinated inauthentic behavior. I mean, I would just love it won't happen. I would just love that before the next US election, you know, that kind of troll farm behavior, that mass deceptive behavior would become illegal. That would be a real breakthrough for the transparency of our kind of public discourse.
So rather than saying the focus being on individual messages, but rather the networks that have been developed to
spread them. Look, it's okay for a campaign to say, we are a campaign and we are pushing this message and this is who we are and this is how much money we have and this is who's funding us. But when you just have this kind of mass behavior online, which looks organic, but is actually coordinated in a very nefarious and deceptive way, I really think that has to stop. And I do think that we do need, you know, basic transparency for the internet. So if you see a piece of content, you know who's behind it, you know who's been pushing it, you know how much money they spent, just that basic stuff. I think we're going to move towards that in Europe. I think the EU and the British legislation will really focus on transparency, because that's just the one thing we can all agree on. Sadly, yeah. I don't think it's going to happen in America. So we're going to have another crazy election in America with, you know, just this complete cluster explosion, I won't swear on your podcast, of all kinds of deceptive behavior and covert influence. What I'm interested in is, we know the big actors. We know, we have kind of an idea what they're going to do. I wonder to what extent we're going to see these kind of, I don't know, self-starting unofficial campaigns having a really big influence this election, whether it's the Lincoln Project, which is a kind of, you know, a group of Republicans who are anti-Trump, who are doing some really, really, you know, quite hardcore videos online, through to the alt-right or various groups that support Donald Trump doing their work. We're just in this weird world now where it's not just the official campaigns, it's also these kind of, you know, self-starting groups which are perfectly capable of doing quite sophisticated information operations. So I wonder whether, apart from, like, you know, the big players, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, I wonder whether this election is going to be the one where it really is kind of the war of all against all. And what does that mean for trying to understand its dynamics and what is going to be kind of the winning, you know, the winning tiny fraction that gets somebody over the line?
And Phil, I mean, what do you think we should be looking out for?
Yeah, I certainly share Peter's instinct on these things. I'd say there's two additional things that are worth being wary of. I think the misinformation is going to pivot, and especially in the U.S. context, to be about voter suppression more this time in 2020 than it ever has been before. And it's likely that messages that try to get people to stay at home or vote on the wrong day or think their candidates dropped out, I think that messaging will be tied to COVID. So you shouldn't vote if you're a Democrat in a certain state, because you'll be taking on some risks. And so it's misinformation around election systems themselves. I think we're going to see that flourish, bloom in the US election, and it'll probably leak over into the other democracies that try to run elections. The other thing that's worrying to me is that I think more and more of this misinformation is becoming business opportunities. So for grifters who want to make a little bit of money, perhaps by producing a documentary on how the pandemic is a falsehood, right? Generate some clickbait headlines, set up a website, and maybe try to sell a book as part of it. That's locally grown misinformation. It's really just about generating some money, and stamping out those kinds of efforts will be one of the big challenges for those of us trying to keep our democracy sane.
Great. And so I'd like to bring in now Charles Creel and John Quinlan, who are on a regular watch out and lookout for us for things we should be worried about on disinformation. Charles, what's caught your eye in the last few days?
Thanks, Damien. I think I'm here today to bring every strand of disinformation together that we've discussed on the show. What I'd like to do is take you down the rabbit hole of my favorite coronavirus meme of the week, and maybe my favorite one of all time. It's titled Mark of the Beast. And what it is an image of a poster. It's been going around, and it's an entire COVID conspiracy story with all the paranoia. First, the name, of course, comes from Revelation, and the poster itself contains a series of pictures that outline a method for the subjugation of humanity. And according to this pictogram, the six steps of this are creating a virus, implementing a lockdown, creating a cashless society, installing 5G globally, inventing RFID technology, and then injecting that technology as a vaccination. And the poster boy for vaccinations on this poster is Bill Gates. And along the way, you also find out that COVID-19 stands for Certificate of Vaccination Identification. Now, that narrative makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever, and I was very confused by it, but there's a helpful link to a YouTube video that sheds a bit more light on the subject. The video is what was just described as an attempt to sell books, actually. It's an excerpt from a 2014 interview with Anthony Patch, and Patch is the editor of Entangled magazine, which bills itself as, quote, your unique source for leading-edge insights into the hidden aspects of science and biblical scripture. And in the video, Patch explains the entire theory of human subjugation, which is all about vaccination. First, the point of the conspiracy is to get people to demand vaccination. Inside this vaccine, there's a DNA manipulator with a third strand of DNA that's constructed of silicone and coated in 1/1,000,000,000th of a millimeter of gold. And you inject the third strand of DNA through the vaccine. So what the government has done, according to Patch, is create both a problem and a solution, creating the virus and then the vaccine. And they're getting the public to demand this solution, to demand being vaccinated. Very clever, right? So why would they do this? Because the third strand of DNA will force your DNA to transform, and you'll become a hybrid being incapable of making your own decisions, a bit like me. The government then takes control of the vaccinated to turn them into a class of serfs who will serve the elite. And the reason that they need to serve the elite is so that they can manufacture technologies to make it possible for the elite to live forever. And the elites are, in fact, not the government and politicians, but a small group of people who've been in control of humanity since ancient times.
Please tell me it's not the Illuminati again.
Well, for me, it begs the question, if they've been in control of humanity since ancient times, then surely they must already be immortal.
That is very true. And you'd also question what they're doing without power as well.
Yeah, indeed. So this video, by the way, is still up on YouTube. And if Google wants to get in touch with us, we'll be happy to tell you where to find it so you can take it down.
Very good. John, tell us a bit about Infotagen in the last few days. What have you been noticing there?
It's been an interesting week. Probably not quite as interesting as that meme that Charles just described, but you know, we do our best. Obviously, you got a personal shout out from David Icke, Damien, which was quite fun for us all, and I think recognition that we're probably on the right path, I suspect.
Yeah, exactly. If David Icke's having a go, you're doing something right.
Yeah, exactly. We're happy to have another Twitter follower, to be honest with you. I think we always like to focus on the sort of one or two claims that really caught our eye. And this week, for us, it's one around immunity, actually, or potential immunity, I should say, which is in a YouTube video from Professor Dolores Cahill from the University of Dublin. We got asked to fact check the claim that after you've had COVID-19, are you immune for life? Which is a claim made in a video and an interview she did. Obviously goes without saying that, clearly not, that you know the COVID-19 immunity and its longevity have not been proven by anyone yet. So I think it's an important one because you know it could affect people's behavior in breaking lockdown or anything like that. And she is, you know, she's listed on the University of Dublin's UCD's website as a sort of an expert, and so people may listen to her. So it is an important one, and it goes down to some of the things that we've seen before, and some of the things you were saying before, that Damien, isn't it? This is not about obviously the medical cure for COVID necessarily. It's more about the kind of social effects afterwards. And I think that, you know, the civil liberties side of things has come up before for us. And this is a sort of an extension of that, in that some people, and, you know, Professor Cahill is also happens to be the chairman of the Irish Freedom Party, which are a right-wing group in Ireland. Some people have got an agenda here politically as well, which is, again, what you were saying.
Yeah, it's interesting. Going back to, Phil, what you said a few moments ago, there seems to be high level of sophistication about the way some of these films are being put together to build the profile of an academic or a researcher with slightly controversial views, but to try and present them as a reasonable and mainstream authority on this subject. And I mean, do you think one of the problems that we've got at the moment is that although the viewing figures for things like the BBC News have been very high throughout the crisis, there are so many alternative sources of news and information now that it's quite easy to spread confusion or doubts, particularly around an issue where there's still a lot that we simply just don't know about coronavirus.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're all eager to find the truths and understand what's behind it all. And I think we have these, we all have cognitive biases, right? We all want to look for, we don't like to find information that contradicts some decision we've made in the past. I think one of the big things that's changed, though, is that the Chinese state-backed media systems and the Russian state-backed media systems are generating immense amounts of misinformation now in English on social media. And that's, you know, that takes URLs and gives them an expanded coverage that they didn't have. I mean, China was interested in what the world thought about protests in Hong Kong, but they didn't really start operating in English in a massive way until they wanted to prevent us from calling it the Wuhan virus, and until they wanted to make sure that there were a few economic consequences coming out of the Trump's White House. So I think these massive mechanisms, you know, we just did a study last week. We found that this between RT and CGTN and Sputnik and several of the other Chinese properties, they can theoretically reach a billion social media user accounts across 5 or 6 different platforms. It's an immense reach, and they operate, I mean, they move in the same direction. They're a team pulling in the same direction, getting us to doubt our own political institutions.
And that's, I mean, Peter, that's often been one of the classic plays, particularly from the Russians, on disinformation, which is not necessarily to prove a counter-narrative, but just to leave you feeling that you don't know who to believe.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a tactic that internationally Russia really kind of pioneered, but that we see being used nationally by lots of different political actors. I think it's partly, you know, born out of a reality where, you know, if you're powerful, you still can't really control the information space at home or even globally. And so, you know, your best tactic is spreading doubt. You know, that's just born out of the nature of the system, which is kind of leans towards that kind of propaganda strategy. But, you know, I think we can go on and on. And my book obviously is an attempt to go deeper and see what's happening in our culture, what's happening historically, that suddenly there's an audience for that kind of doubt as well. You know, that kind of cynicism and relativism that it implies seems to appeal. Because we also have to think about the demand side of disinformation. We talk a lot about, you know, the supply side, how it's created, who it's created by, their tactics, their aims. But propaganda, you know, throughout the history of the world, only really works when it's somehow coincides with some sort of overt or covert desires of people. So that's kind of what I find so fascinating as well.
Absolutely. And we were talking on the previous Infotainment podcast with Tristan Harris, and he sort of spoke about the idea of a kind of mimetic virus, information virus that spreads and sort of takes hold of people and then uses those people to propagate that virus. And it seems that we need to think about what the antidote to that virus is, you know, that just in the way we have to come up with an antidote to coronavirus, we need to come up with an antidote to disinformation, and in particular, to
social media distancing, Damien, that
exactly,
clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like everyone stays 2 meters. I mean, I'm half joking. I mean, something that Carl Miller and others have said, that, look, maybe the best thing is just slowing the whole thing down, you know. The rapidity of the way things spread online is part of the problem. And if you just introduce friction, which would be the social media equivalent of distancing, maybe things would get better. I don't know if that's a great solution, but maybe that's one thing to think about. A bit like social distancing, it doesn't feel like a permanent kind of way forward.
Yeah, and people have got people measure 2 meters in different ways as well, I think. But, yes. But what would that be? So like a kind of, you know, the next step feature on YouTube, you get a little black screen saying, are you sure you really want to watch this before
it starts playing? I think that, it's very interesting looking at kind of the exchange of sort of metaphors between, you know, we used to talk about disinformation as a virus, and this virus comes along, which is a real virus. Now we have disinformation about the virus, and you know, this very strange kind of coming together of these two of the real virus and the kind of the metaphorical way we think about disinformation. I think what is very true is, I mean, I actually had COVID, and when you come down with COVID, in my case anyway, you don't so much think about your own health. I guess in my case, I wasn't really under threat, but you start thinking about who did I give it to, you know, the you know, guests who came round, or the teachers at school where your kids are. And you know, I think what's so interesting about contemporary propaganda is that we all spread, you know, we all spread the propaganda. We all pass it on. We're not merely passive receivers of disinformation. We're mini little propaganda machines ourselves, sharing and retweeting. And probably if we're talking about, you know, the big change that needs to happen, one is regulatory that I mentioned, but the other one is, yes, changing, you know, none of this propaganda works with us being the kind of the link that furthers it.
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to draw our discussion to an end, but it's been great to have you on the podcast. Phil, Peter, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Philip Howard, Peter Pomerantsev, Charles Creel, and John Quinlan. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagent and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you until next time.